Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today Mr. Gary Fiskejohn, who is a senior editor at Knopf and is one of our country's most illustrious editors. And first of all, Gary, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I first started reading your name when I discovered the short stories of Raymond Carver. And take us back in time a little bit to Raymond Carver. And what was it about Carver's work as an editor that so drew you to his style?
Well, I'd first read Ray before I was in publishing. He was one of my kind of childhood or college age heroes. And his first book, Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, I believe came out in 1976. And I'd read that many, many times and got into publishing, ended up reviewing his second book for the Village Voice. And the guy who I was working at Random House then, and my boss said, "Do you think this guy's good?" And I said, "I think he's the best story writer in the country for any number of reasons. I mean, extremely funny, he had a very pure vision of life's impurities, I suppose." And to this guy, I said, "Well, go after him." Because the second book was published by Black Sparrow, or not Black Sparrow, it was published by Capra Press, and I thought it was kind of absurd that he didn't have a major publisher. So I called him up. He was living in El Paso then, and in fact, he did have obligations to other major publishers, but Ray was certainly always interested in people who were interested in him. At any rate, we became friends, and before long, I was editing him, and that lasted from, well, the friendship would have gone from probably 79 or something like that until he died in 1988, I think it was.
Okay.
So it was a tremendous run. I mean, I published a lot of his poetry as well. He's probably undervalued as a poet. Certainly, I don't know of any writer who had anything like the impact or influence on other writers, so that therefore there are a lot of people trying to write like Ray, and the simplicity of his style is very difficult to master. And when it's not mastered, it seems clumsy, unformed, unfinished, all sorts of things. I mean, any great writer can't be imitated. I don't know if he's probably as much imitated now as he was, but I certainly hope he's read as much as he was. Because by any standard, you know, he's in the handful of great American story writers.
So how did you actually get into the editing process? You said you were reviewing?
Well, I'd come to New York. I graduated with degrees in philosophy and literature and history, which didn't avail me of many employment opportunities. I never once, though, I worked, you know, wrote crummy stories and poems myself. I worked at the literary magazine. Not only did I never think of publishing as a possible job, none of my friends did either. But I did have two friends who I graduated with who went to a publishing course at Radcliffe, which is, you know, kind of the oldest, longest-running publishing course. It's now at Columbia for the last 2, 3, 4 years. Went to that and drifted down to New York and got a job. And I was reviewing for The Voice just because, you know, I needed to make more than, you know, $400 a month.
Right.
And so I kind of lucked into it. And I lucked into it at a lucky time because, you know, from the end of the 60s well into the 70s, and I started in 77, people weren't going to New York, they were going someplace else. So that a lot of publishing companies, the executives would look around and realize that they were all middle-aged and not getting any younger. And so it was, you know, if you had any kind of gumption or talent for it, it was a good time to come into it because they were looking for people who could, they could bring along. Mm-hmm. And so it was lucky in all sorts of ways. And I mean, my other great college favorite was Tom McGuane, and I'd publish him. mm-hmm. too. So I thought I was kind of lucky. The two people I liked the most, and they couldn't be more different
yeah.
as writers or anything else. Before, you know, really, before very long, I knew them both, friends with them both, and then ended up working with them both.
And then you were with Random House in the 80s, is that correct?
Yeah, I was at Random House from the spring of 78 until June of 86.
Okay, so you were there when the Vintage Contemporaries...
I more or less started.
You more or less started that,
yep.
which was, when I look back during that period of time, I can see the title still, The Sports Writer, Bright Lights, Big City, Mohawk. Mm-hmm. It was really a revolutionary trend in publishing at the time.
Well, it was one of those, it was a revolutionary idea, and like any revolutionary idea that worked, it was so obvious that anybody could have come up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because prior to that time, most contemporary fiction, you know, and I'm talking loosely about literary fiction,
right.
not sort of potential bestseller, potboiler stuff, most of those books would be reprinted by mass market paperback company, which didn't really have the right kind of distribution for books that only serious readers would be drawn to. So they kept wondering why they were publishing these books and not very, you know, they a literary book that became very successful, they could sell that well
mm-hmm.
in mass market paperback, but that's one in 100
mm-hmm.
or at best probably. The other 99 weren't selling at all, so they stopped reprinting a lot of books. Publishing it by the late 70s was very anemic, so you wouldn't, even if a book succeeded, it was selling a number of copies that nowadays would be laughable. Not going into paperback, you know, the hardcover publishers losing money because they don't get any paperback money at all. And meanwhile, there are all these different trade paperback lines, whether Vintage or Penguin or, you know, any number of others. Those would be the two biggest. But they were wary of doing contemporary fiction because there was too much of it. And so, like at Vintage, we had a terrific backlist of literature, but it was by dead people.
Right.
Faulkner was great, but Cormac McCarthy didn't want to hear about. It seemed to me ridiculous, and I had started, I think it was probably about 1980, I did two books by Don DeLillo in Vintage, and tried to keep them cheap, and tried to make them probably look cheap, too, to appeal to a wider number of readers. They did okay, but that clearly wasn't the approach to take, and then I was reprinting Bray's work. I did one volume that did very well, and that was right when his career was taking off. So that worked. And then when I read DeLillo's book, The Names, I said, this is so great, I got to try again. And I did uniform editions of, eventually, I think, five of his books. And this was before he'd had any hardcover success whatsoever. And this one of my sales guys came in and said, I can't believe these books are selling. So that told me a few things, that there is a market for that kind of book, and if it's well packaged, ideally with some kind of uniform look. People go into a bookstore and it's bewildering, the number of titles, and you can't look at everything. But if you see something that, you know, if there's a book that in a series that you've liked, you're going to be inclined to give another book in that same series, you know, a look before you might pick up something that you've never, didn't know really anything about.
Sure.
So that was the whole genesis of Vintage Contemporaries, and it worked phenomenally well. I mean, the first list, we had six books, five of which were reprints, and Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City. And it took a lot of conversation with Jay to get him to agree to foregoing the hardcover. We had a lot of mutual friends. I said, well, you could be like Scott Summer, you could be like Greg Barron, you can be like any number of people whose books will come out and sell 1,800 copies in hardcover, so you have a nice hardcover collector's item. Never go into paperback, never get any readers at all. I said, that's the likely fate, no matter how good this book is.
Mm-hmm.
And so he happily kind of agreed to this experiment, and I think he agreed because, you know, a number of his favorite writers were in this same list. So that if you're published on a list with Ray Carver, with Tom McGuane, with Peter Matheson, with Paula Marshall, with Janet Hobhouse, with Jim Crumley, nobody can say that you hadn't passed some quality test.
Right.
I mean, by the company you keep, you're already ahead of the game. So I said, these people's critical reputation will reflect well on you. And it turned out, I think, that that was the case. However, the wild success of Bright Lights, Big City did wonders for all those other people.
Sure.
And really established a list so that, which I ran, we started in September of 84, and I left less than 2 years later, but I'd published or planned at least two and a half years worth of publications for those. And I was still doing some books in hardcover, but the books that I thought had the most potential, I'd go straight into paperback with. Mm-hmm. And that included Richard Ford's A Sports Writer, Rick Russo's first book, Mohawk. And in a way, the success of those sorts of books got to a point where before long, people in sales and marketing were saying, you know, people now are very interested in contemporary fiction. They'd rather have it in hardcover. So for a while, I thought that the whole peculiarity of American publishing starts with the fact that you can buy it now or you can wait a year and get it for a third of the price or half the price or whatever. No other business operates that way.
Yeah. When there was kind of a snobbery against trade paperbacks at first, because you did nice paperbacks. It mm-hmm. wasn't the big, fat, mass-market paperback.
Sure.
And there was
no, they acceptance. Were great-looking, and I think a well-made trade paperback is preferable in many respects to a hardcover. But I continued doing some when I went to Atlantic, which I ran from 86 to 90. And but there had, in fact, the growth of contemporary fiction in trade paperback kind of rearranged bookstores. I mean, mm-hmm. bookstores wouldn't have, you know, a quarter of their stock devoted to contemporary fiction in trade paperback edition, but
right.
they suddenly could. And these people then were suddenly getting read, and there was a big market for them, and where there's a big market, then you can revert to the kind of cockamamie notion of doing it in an expensive hardback edition. Author makes more money, publisher makes more money, and then you can sell a bunch in paperback afterward.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the biggest change I've ever seen in publishing. Mm-hmm. But it was something so obvious that it was, you didn't have to be very visionary to come up with the idea.
Well, you mentioned one of my favorite writers, Jim Crumley.
Mm-hmm.
And The Last Good Kiss is one of my favorite books of all time. And I imagine in the trade paper, he's probably sold a scad more copies of that than he did.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
You know, Jim had a lot of, I mean, Random House was publishing him then, and he had a lot of fans around Random House.
Yeah.
And, but he hadn't really sold any number of copies because he didn't, you know, genre fiction probably was doing better than what I'd call real fiction, because you can just say, if you like mysteries, you'll like this guy, or you like her work, it'll be fabulous. Jim didn't fit neatly into any category, and those are the kind of publishers I like best. They're also the hardest ones to publish successfully, but he had a real good run in vintage, and I think he's just finished a new book.
Yeah, he did. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
He's a raucous writer, but mm-hmm. when you read him, you have to be careful who you recommend him to, because I've recommended his work to some people, and they say, Casey, that's a little blue.
I hear you. Yeah.
Well, tell us about Knopf now. You're senior editor at Knopf, and I understand you spend part of your time in Tennessee and part of your time in New York. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And who are you spending most? I mean, and when I think of Gary Fiskejohn, I think of the classic author-editor relationships that go back to the 30s and the 40s,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people want to work with you. Mm-hmm. What kind of a list are you working with now?
Well, it's, you know, many people I've worked with for ages. I mean, Richard Ford I've worked with mm-hmm. since The Sports Writer. He's got a new book, which I'll get in September.
Good.
From him, which we'll publish next year. Toby Wolf, I worked with for a long time, carry on with. And, you know, I'm always looking for new people, but I'm happily supplied with new books by people I've, you know, published many times by now. So that, I mean, write an upcoming list. I mean, Cormac McCarthy's new book comes out today, in fact.
Oh, is it today?
Yep.
Oh, good.
And he gets a mediocre review from Cacatani and the Times. We published Bret Easton Ellis' new book, which is a masterpiece, I think, in about a month's time. I'm publishing a fellow called Andrew Del Banco, who I've never worked with before, but who's written a magnificent biography of Herman Melville.
Yeah.
Then in the winter, I'm publishing new novels by Julian Barnes, a new novel by Jay McInerney.
Oh, good.
A new novel by Stephen Wright, which I think will really put him on the map.
Good.
Kind of a cult writer who's never been read.
Yeah, he's been
down
here at Sewanee several times.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was on faculty back in the mid-90s.
Huh.
Yeah.
This is a really terrific book called The Amalgamation Polka, which is, for anybody who's read Stephen Wright, they would reckon him the least likely contemporary writer to write a Civil War novel, but that's what he's done. And it is unlike any Civil War book I've ever read. Got a new book by Bill Barish about Irish horse racing. A new novel by a young writer called Mike Heppner, who I published his first book called The Egg Coat a couple of years ago. And then the subsequent list, which I think, well, that will start in May of next year. A new, really great new novel by Steve Yarborough, who I published the last two books with.
The Oxygen Man?
Yeah.
James Lee Burke told me about The Oxygen Man.
Pardon?
James Lee Burke told me about The Oxygen Man.
So?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give him an early look at this one then.
Yeah, good.
Fabulous new collection of stories by Tom McGuane.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A great big collection of stories by Haruki Murakami.
Wonderful.
Collection of stories by Alex Olin, whose first novel just came out, and who's here at Sewanee this year. What else is on that list?
So you like Bret Easton Ellis. You like the new one that's coming out, what, next month, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a really, really good book. Far and away the best thing he's done.
Good.
And some of the early reviews have suggested that even people who are bound and determined to hate him will not be able to deny his talent.
Good.
Having read this book, if they bother to read it.
Yeah.
What else is on that list? Well, there's plenty of books. And next fall, I'll publish Rick Brusso's new book, I think. Richard Ford's new book. So they keep coming along.
Beautiful list out, yeah.
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 Kind of all right.
Yeah. Now, Gary, how does it work, with agents, for the aspiring writers that are listening to the show or the writers that are down here at Sewanee, the critical thing for them to do is to write their best work and get an agent, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then if the agent thinks it's of a high enough quality, eventually they're going to show it to
you.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody in publishing, whether it's an agent or a publisher, you're looking for work you like. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking to somebody this morning, and he said, well, who would be the best agent? I said, the best agent is somebody who likes your work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a frustrating thing. It's almost a catch-22. Publishers don't like to see unagented stuff. Some publishers refuse delivery of it. It's returned to sender. We look at everything, but the odds of coming in over the transom and having somebody's assistant fall in love with it, hand it up the food chain, if it's really strong work, there's not a good novel floating around America unpublished right now.
Okay.
There's a lot of almost good ones, but really good work will get taken on, and it's worth young writers beating their heads against the wall to get an agent. If this agent doesn't get it, doesn't like it, doesn't read it, try another one. Because once an agent is on your side, an agent knows more about publishing than the best informed aspiring writer ever could. And that's their job. That's what they do. And so That's what I always tell people. I said, you know, obviously you send something in, my assistant will look at it. If it's good enough, she'll hand it on to me. I'll look at it. But I've probably only bought a couple of things in my life that way. Yeah. And I published hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. Getting in, there's a lot of people who get agents and can get very good agents. Can't find anybody who wants to publish it. But your odds are still much better. You're giving your work the best possible chance. And so I've never varied from that advice.
Good. Well, Gary, thank you very much for your time today.
You betcha.
I love having these names that you're tossing out because they're my favorite writers. I'm really excited that McWayne's got a book of stories coming out.
And it's a terrific collection. And he's had a funny career. I mean, he was a big thing, certainly for me, when I was reading him in college. And I think he was, you know, became famous, then became kind of infamous, then kind of fell off the radar for a while. But he's had kind of a second. He's on a roll right now. I mean, he's got a story in Best American for, I guess it's, will be dated Best American 2005. He's published very routinely in the New Yorker. I think that's widening his audience, and he's always grown as a writer. I mean, all of these people are not writing the same book over and over again. They're always doing something different. And this is, he's only published one collection of stories before, a book called To Skin a Cat, which came out in 1986, I believe. So there's a lot of good stuff to pick from here. And
that's great.
And we're going to do a lot to win him again, the readership that he's deserved for quite a long time.
When you have to be thrilled with Richard Russo with the success he's having.
Yeah. And it, well deserved. You know, and it's, we worked together on Mohawk, then I left Random House, so they kept throwing money at him to stay. And did an okay job, but we tried to get his contract shifted to me at Knopf for Nobody's Fool. Random House didn't care for that idea. But then with Empire Falls, we got off to a very good start. And we'd kept up in the intervening years, but I hadn't spent all that much time around him. But for all the success he's had, hadn't changed one iota.
That's great.
Just a fabulous, generous, big-hearted guy. And so I can't wait to read this new book.
Good. Well, thanks so much for your time, and thank you for all the wonderful editing you do.
Thanking you.